From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. There's overwhelming evidence that the higher the level of self-esteem, the more likely one will be to treat others with respect, kindness, and generosity. Ever thankful for being given an hour of my listeners' precious time, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. The late American writer John Steinbeck, author of such classic novels as East of Eden and The Grapes of Wrath, once commented on the condition of human existence with the following criticism. Quote Steinbeck, "It has always seemed strange to me, the things we admire in men, kindness and generosity, openness, honesty, understanding and feeling, are the concomitants of failure in our system. And those traits we detest, sharpness, greed, acquisitiveness, meanness, egotism, and self-interest, are the traits of success. And while men love the quality of the first, they love the produce of the second." Now, those of you already familiar with his work, and who are regular listeners to VSI, will perhaps be surprised when I tell you that I am actually quite a fan of John Steinbeck, and The Grapes of Wrath in particular. In his capacity as a writer, he excelled in his work, and I should acknowledge that. Yeah, credit where credit's due. If I perhaps sound a bit cautious in my praise for Steinbeck's work, it's only because of the profound chasm between his overall philosophical position and my own. While I usually try not to ascribe guilt by association, the company that Steinbeck kept was often unsavory and included hard-left authors and journalists, as well as labor union personalities. As a very young man, Steinbeck was mentored by such overtly Marxist personalities from the literary world, such as Soviet sympathizer Lincoln Stephens. He was furthermore associated with Francis Whitaker from the Writers' Club of the United States Communist Party. However, Steinbeck is perhaps best known for his association with playwright and professed radical Arthur Miller, the man behind the now classic stage play Death of a Salesman, and also famous for having been once married to Marilyn Monroe. Whether one can or cannot judge a man by the company he keeps, his radical leanings and the influence of those around him show up clearly in his work. Still, what I liked so much about Steinbeck's novels, and I'm thinking of The Grapes of Wrath in particular, was the great deal of intellectual honesty the novel contained. The stories about the plight of the Joad family during the Dust Bowl era, as they inched their way toward California, hoping to find gainful employment, after having lost the family farm due to crop failure and their subsequent inability to pay the loan on the property, and the continuous frustration they faced in procuring itinerant employment, working in direct exchange for lodging and food, taking low-paid manual labor in the orchards, and scrounging as hard as they could just to keep from starving, including sweeping up the flour from the floors of train cars in order to gather enough together just to make a simple loaf of bread or porridge that would have to be split several ways. The story also inserted a few scenes meant to be a kind of critical social commentary, such as the desperate hungry man having stolen a handful of potatoes from a farmer's storehouse, only to be shot in the back as he tried to escape from the farmer, who was guarding his inventory with a shotgun. This was Steinbeck's criticism of property rights as he saw it, the cruelty of someone with plenty going to extremes to keep what is his when someone else is in dire need. As for the Joad family members themselves, they are presented in a most interesting way, and as characters, they give lie to the notion that everyone in a state of dire poverty or hardship necessarily has himself to blame in every case, as in spite of being simple folk, these were clearly very hard-working, inventive, and indeed very clever people making the most of their situation, no matter how difficult, and taking every opportunity that came their way to help themselves out of their predicaments, only soon after to have some other unforeseen event thwart their efforts and bring them back to square one. I remember reading the book and nearly pulling my own hair out in frustration, in sympathy for the characters. That's how well written it is. Readers from all walks of life and all kinds of dispositions and value systems can easily identify with the Joad family. You almost wish you could reach inside the book and help them out. When I say it was an intellectually honest novel, what I mean is that what really stands out is the fact that, with few exceptions, if any, nobody was really the bad guy in the story. Readers cannot really put their fingers on anyone in particular to blame for the Joad family's suffering, and nobody in the story tries to thwart their efforts. Even those people who are better off than Joads are still making the best of a bad situation. The message I got from The Grapes of Wrath was that, even in spite of his best efforts, not every man is able to pull himself up by his bootstraps, and it's not necessarily anyone's fault. I gathered then, even without knowing the political leanings of Steinbeck at the time, that he was making an argument against laissez-faire. As well, there was a profoundly pragmatic streak to the message in that abstractions as property, rights, and contracts should give way when men, either as individuals or as a community, are faced with cold, hard concretes, concerns like hunger. Now, I've not read the book in 15 years, so I'm not certain I remember correctly, but I don't think Steinbeck ever comes out to state any such moral or political stances overtly. But that also is a great strength in the novel. So much is open to discussion. I really hope that The Grapes of Wrath is assigned and read by high school English classes in the United States, assuming any books are read anymore in high school, and that such discussions are held by the pupils in class, just because the book would be so well suited for such an exercise. What I also found exceptionally clever about the book is something that other people have criticized, and that's the very end of the story. While reading the book, the tone of the story and the direction in which the reader is being taken leads you to believe that we'll all come to a definitive conclusion, but indeed the story stops short. We never really learn of the ultimate fate of the Joad family. Did they eventually perish from exhaustion or starvation? Did they manage to survive for many more years, albeit at such a miserable level? Did they make it to California and find gainful work and make a dignified life for themselves, the long ordeal finally over? By the end of the book, all three possibilities seem equally plausible, and that's another strength of his writing. Again, high school English classes could discuss these, or even other possible fates that might be consistent with the story, both in plot and in having become familiar with the characters. Not only is The Grapes of Wrath an intellectually honest book within the covers, not making anyone in particular out to be the bad guy, it's intellectually honest in appealing to readers. It does not convey the typical socialist arrogance you find in, say, newspaper op-ed pieces. Rather, I think that any reader, no matter where he sits on the political spectrum, will find The Grapes of Wrath to be very compelling in its presentation, even if it fails to win anyone over to the political leanings that eventually become obvious. Even I, personally being utterly devoid of any socialist sentiments, did not feel like I was being browbeaten or moralized when reading the book. I did not feel like the book was an affront to individualists or capitalists as such, even though the book did quite clearly offer social commentary and harsh criticism, albeit in a cool-headed manner and modest in presentation, of what are necessarily individualistic and capitalistic principles. As a reader, I felt that John Steinbeck in The Grapes of Wrath was very respectful to me, essentially saying, "Here's my argument, and a fictional but realistic scenario demonstrating why I feel this way. Make your own conclusion." Further to the brilliance of this novel in itself, setting aside what I now know to have been Steinbeck's political values, is that it is not exactly obvious just what the book was arguing. Was it against capitalism? Was it against doctrinaire individualism and rigidity in interpreting rules? Was it against property rights? Or, on the other hand, perhaps it was an argument for something. Was the story an argument for centralized economy? Was it more modest in its aims, finding room for such things as government poor relief and obligatory assistance within a framework of freedom? Again, the reader is left to make his own decision. So if there is a diamond in the rough, and I do mean rough, of the plethora of otherwise tiresome left-wing literature out there, it is John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. Highly recommended. Now, as it turns out, Steinbeck himself would later claim that in writing the book, he really did mean to get people upset, and said, "I've done my damnedest to rip a reader's nerves to rags." So perhaps he'd be rolling in his grave if he could know that he was being given such a positive review on a program such as VSI. Well, perhaps he outdid himself. If I could have spoken to him when he was alive, I would tell John Steinbeck that he had made one of his staunchest detractors in politics into a big fan in terms of literature. Good work, John. Now, addressing Steinbeck's quotation once more, namely that he always found it strange that we admire kindness and generosity, openness, honesty, understanding and feeling, but that they are, as he puts it, the concomitants of failure in our system, while the traits of success involve sharpness, greed, acquisitiveness, meanness, egotism, and self-interest. More interesting is his final observation that we love the quality of the first, namely kindness and generosity, but we love the produce of the second, greed and meanness. You may have noticed in his quotation one of the many common rhetorical devices of the left, a feigned lack of understanding. It's meant to convey a sense of aloofness or superiority. Firstly, a critical and insulting observation is made about the society in which we mere mortals live and our behaviors within it, but then we're to gather that the speaker making the comment lives on a higher plane of existence on which the criticized phenomenon is so unknown and so unfamiliar to him and his enlightened ilk that they just don't understand. Of course, the exact opposite is the case. Leftists believe, consciously, that they understand everything perfectly well, and it is we, the mere mortals, who don't understand the wretchedness of our own condition. You can be sure that Steinbeck felt he knew that mankind valued kindness but practiced greed, and he understood that such was just plain wrong, even if nobody else understood that. However, his quotation does betray a certain misunderstanding that's very prevalent in modern Western culture. Notice the curious juxtaposition of the purported virtues and vices listed in Steinbeck's quotation, and more precisely what it is that he thinks leads to success and failure. Why should generosity, openness, and honesty necessarily lead to failure? How many people who are chronic failures in life can afford to be generous? I'll grant you that dishonest people can often make quick kills, but how long-term is such false success in general? Now, I suppose we never hear about the dishonest people who never get caught in their dishonesty, and there may be many liars and cheaters who get away forever with their crooked behavior. What I challenge is the implied notion that dishonesty is necessarily an element of success. I like to think that I'm very honest in my dealings with people. Then again, how successful I am is a matter of debate. Of course, it's not about me, but instead of conducting a survey of the rich and famous and debating about how honorable their careers have been, I'd simply like to ask you to ask yourself the following question. In what kind of moral system is honesty necessarily a losing proposition? Is such a moral code even practicable? And then success requires greed, meanness, and self-interest? Well, on the last count, yes, self-interest, concern with one's own well-being and situation in life. I'll concede that it's unlikely that a man with no concern for his own personal success will experience personal success. And what is greed? Is it simply wanting to have more than one has at the given moment? If that's all it takes to be greedy, then damned be every student trying to better himself intellectually and becoming of greater value to his fellow man. Damned be the job seeker looking to provide for his own sustenance by means of his own effort. Or is greed found in wanting and attempting to get more than one really needs? Well, if so, then damned be anyone who's been generous in any regard, and at some time has possessed more than he needed and was able to extend generosity to another person. Or would Steinbeck's moral code demand that, indeed, a man do no more than obtain what he absolutely needs, a single potato a day, perhaps, and then still give that potato to someone else and have oneself go hungry? Or perhaps greed is wanting to take things that belong to other people without earning it. Well, Steinbeck's entire complaint in The Grapes of Wrath was that the right to property stood in the way of people getting their fair share in tough times. And what about acquisitiveness, the act or propensity to gather and collect material things for oneself? Taking the positive actions to better one's own material being? Well, if that's immoral, then damn all of us who are not living in caves and possessing little more than a bear skid, a club, and a chunk of raw meat. What kind of moral code would make demands that were physically impossible to practice, but then all the same condemn a man for not practicing it? What kind of code would essentially tell man that he has nothing to gain from morality, that morality is indeed his deadliest weapon, as adherence to its principles could only lead to ultimate self-destruction, and that the mere existence of other people is in itself a threat to his own existence and well-being? If such a moral code were ever to be taken seriously, what would human relations be like? How long would men treat each other morally, if moral behavior itself were a detriment to those who practiced it, while those ignoring such a morality would thrive? Surely no twisted and perverse moral code could ever be taken seriously or survive long. Its absurdity would just be too apparent to too many people. Well, you'd think so when I present it so bluntly, but indeed there is a moral code that demands all that and more. Such a moral code is alive and well today, even though any of its sincere adherents could not possibly be. This moral code has in fact been the prevalent moral doctrine for the past few centuries, and it is, above all else, the single phenomenon most responsible for the arrested development of mankind today. That moral code is altruism. The word altruism is widely misunderstood when used in common parlance, but it's perfectly understood by its fiercest proponents. Make no mistake, altruism is not kindness, it's not generosity, it's not goodwill or respect. Neither does it have anything to do with charitable giving. In fact, altruism is not to be found or seen in any actions taken. You can no more see altruism than you can see any other belief as such. What we see are the actions taken by those who may be motivated by a certain belief. That motivation may well be altruism, but it could just as easily be, for instance, a sense of Christian duty, genuine generosity, or perhaps even an act of cynical manipulation or the banking of favors, deliberately making another person obligated to oneself. Notice that altruism is an ism. It is a body of thought, a moral philosophy, and a specific disposition concerning man's relationship to the universe and his relationship to his fellow man. Altruism is an ethical theory that holds that man has no right to exist for his own sake, that service to others is the only justification of his existence, and that self-sacrifice is a man's highest moral duty. Ultimately, death is the standard of value in altruism, and thus it's logical that every form of suffering and self-destruction are the virtues that altruism advocates. The most salient difference between altruism and, say, generosity or charity can be seen in the very purpose behind any given altruistic or charitable act, respectively. When you extend your generosity to a fellow human being, in any way at all, take something very simple like buying lunch for a coworker of yours from a lower-ranking position in the company and one who clearly earns less money than you do. The purpose of buying him lunch is quite simply so that a coworker of yours, with whom you are presumably on good terms, can have lunch with you, and perhaps you wanted some company during your lunch break. If you were generously to give away a shortwave radio receiver to one of your lucky listeners, you typically would do so because you think that the particular receiver is rather neat and you'd like someone else to have one. Seems simple enough. If you find that a friend of yours or even a stranger is going hungry and you are charitable enough simply to give him some food, the purpose of doing so was quite simply so that friend or stranger would have something to eat and not go hungry. You might think that these are glaringly obvious points. However, the problem is that many people will sloppily use the word altruism to describe the scenarios I just presented, when in fact they have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with altruism. As an ethical philosophy, altruism doesn't even address them. Altruism does not focus at all on the beneficiary of any particular act of giving. Altruism focuses solely on the giver and holds that any action a man takes is moral provided that he himself does not benefit from such an action. In any transaction or exchange between two parties, altruism requires that it not be to mutual benefit, but at a loss to at least one, but if possible both, of the parties involved. Somebody necessarily needs to lose. Some sacrifice has to be made. As an ethical system, altruism is not satisfied with you buying a co-worker lunch. Altruism demands that you be that low-paid worker who can only afford his own lunch, and then nevertheless give his lunch money to someone else, allowing himself to go hungry instead. As an ethical system, altruism is not satisfied with you giving a shortwave receiver to a fellow listener so that he can share in the enjoyment of the hobby. No, altruism demands that even if you only have one shortwave receiver, that you give it to someone else to enjoy and allow yourself to miss out. As an ethical system, altruism is not satisfied with you giving a hungry friend or stranger food you can spare. Altruism demands that you give away food even if you cannot afford to be without, and, strictly speaking, as you likely have some self-interest in helping a friend, inasmuch as we should all feel we have a stake in the well-being of those whom we choose to call our friends, altruism holds that you sacrifice helping your friend and help the stranger instead. Beyond that, a greater sacrifice would be not in helping the stranger to whom you are indifferent, but rather giving it to someone you hate. And finally, giving to an enemy, someone set out to harm you, would be the peak of altruist morality. Ultimately, death is the logical end of altruism. However, short of that, altruism creates a feeling of indifference toward life and death as such. What kind of genuine respect for one's fellow man can any of us have under altruism? How much will we value the life and health of another human being if the mere existence of other people poses a material threat to our own existence? No matter how poor our situation may be at any given moment, there is someone somewhere somewhat worse off than we are. Altruism demands that we give what little we have to someone else. It does not matter at all if that someone else is helped in any meaningful way. What matters to altruism is that we sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice. That's another word that's misused and often misunderstood. Sacrifice, as a word, is often used in a sloppy way to suggest any kind of trade-off. A trade-off itself can be a sacrifice or not. It all depends on what sort of thing is being traded off, and more importantly, how much the person making the trade-off values the exchange. I now cringe at the word sacrifice being used, even in metaphorical contexts. Something as simple as in mechanics, when talking about gears and cogwheels and flywheels and such things, when their function of redistributing energy is discussed in such ways as sacrificing power for speed or sacrificing speed for power. If in the given application speed is more important than power, then trading off power for speed is no sacrifice. In that context, you are better off, not worse. Trading off a lower value for a higher value is not a sacrifice, and the trade-off in question carries no moral weight without reference to the values being traded. Sacrifice means trading a higher value in exchange for a lower value or even a non-value. Many parents of limited means will say things like, "We sacrificed having a big house in order to save money for a son to go to college." If they valued their son having a higher education, if they felt that his having a diploma meant more to them than the big house would be, then it was not a sacrifice. On the contrary, they gave up the less important value of having a big house in exchange for something they valued more, their child's professional future. Now, on the other hand, there are indeed parents who quite literally have sacrificed having a big house in order for their sons to have an education, if they felt that their sons were not really cut out for college and that they would not benefit from it, and felt that they ended up sacrificing having a big house in order to finance their son's 4-year-long dorm parties. However, a studious pupil who surrenders all his spare time to studies and his summers to long hours working to pay his tuition in order to end up with a degree and a professional career is not making a sacrifice. The pupil who quits school in order to work at a menial task at low pay so he can stay close to home to care for his parents is making a sacrifice. Someone who turns down a promotion that might even entail a considerable increase in pay, but that would also entail relocating to another town, is not making a sacrifice if staying close to family and friends is of greater value to him. Someone who turns down a promotion so that another man less worthy can take the position instead is making a sacrifice. If you forgo some small luxury, such as a new ball cap or a round at the bowling alley, in order to spend money on food for a hungry friend, that's not a sacrifice. If you valued the bowl cap or the bowling alley more and you found it would be a sacrifice, well, then you had no business pretending to be his friend. That's the difference between sacrificing on one hand and simply prioritizing on the other. I even find that those of you with religious leanings misuse the word sacrifice when discussing the Christian doctrine of Jesus dying for man's sins. That suggests that God, embodied in Jesus, would rather just have gone on living and let man eventually perish in his sin. John 3:16 reads, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, so that whosoever believe in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life." This suggests quite clearly that no sacrifice was involved, but rather that the salvation of man was so extremely high a value to the Almighty himself that he'd rather even let his own son die in order to secure it. On the other hand, an altruist Bible might read something to the effect of, "God found man wretched and unworthy, but he gave his only begotten son to save mankind, pitiful as he was, because, well, that's just what you do. Sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice, trading a higher value off in favor of a lower value." Altruism is utterly unconcerned with the fate of beneficiaries. Altruism is only concerned with sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice.
This time he's gone for good. He'll never come back now, even though he said he would. So darling, dry your eyes. So many other guys would give the world, I'm sure, to wear the shoes he wore. Oh, come on.
Smile a little smile for me, Rosemary. Where's the use?
Listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. On an earlier episode, I spoke of how good people usually do not understand evil people or what motivates them. Good people tend to put conflicts down to mere misunderstandings, or at worst, a conflict of interest in which both sides have a legitimate claim and whose interests must be balanced against one another. This can clearly be seen in cases where evil people accuse good people of evil, and then the good people simply resort to explaining away their actions in a way that, on the surface, tries to win over the accusers, essentially pleading, "We're not as bad as you think." It's an exercise in utter futility, as indeed such people are talking cross purposes to altruists. What I'm thinking of in particular is the phenomenon in the business world known as corporate social responsibility, or CSR. Many listeners will know what I'm talking about, what CSR, or corporate social responsibility, really amounts to. It is a set of procedures or core values that a large company assumes in order really just to be able to make a big deal about the magnanimity of the company and be able to present a counter-argument to the cookie-cutter, ready-made anti-business smears that altruists of all shades like to sling at just about any large profit-making enterprise. CSR is really just a public relations measure which presents the given company in a more positive light based on a number of altruistic criteria. Firstly, a company's public CSR presentation will mention how much employment the company brings to a certain area and even how many subsequent jobs are created in the said community outside of the company itself, as the presence of the company stimulates the local economy. As well, there'll be a discussion about what the company offers its employees in terms of pay and benefits, as well as how their employees' families benefit, either directly through the company or due to the salaries being offered, allowing employees much more material benefits than they had before the company began operating. CSR involves a commitment to combating child labor and in taking positive steps to ensure that none of the company's suppliers make use of forced labor of any sort. CSR involves a commitment to protecting the environment and in adhering to local health and safety regulations. CSR entails obtaining the necessary liability insurance in order to ensure that anyone who, in the unlikely event of getting hurt or suffering damages from the company's operations, is properly compensated. As well, a good deal of CSR involves giving to charity or being directly involved in some charitable work or sponsoring other worthwhile activities in the community. In general, CSR is a commitment by a company to take responsibility for the overall effect its operation has on the community. Now, when looking at the particular elements involved in CSR in and of themselves, they seem to make a lot of sense. However, when bundled together into an overall concept, CSR is really nothing more than an advance apology made to the altruists for having committed the unpardonable sin of being successful. The measures enacted serve as a kind of atonement, a so-called giving back to society, or other such equine excreta. But notice that the altruists are never placated by this. Has there been one single company ever that, once having been the target of altruistic smears, adopted a policy of corporate social responsibility and then suddenly became the darling of the otherwise anti-business types? Has the Shell Petroleum Company, or Unilever, or Procter & Gamble, or McDonald's? What about all the good that these and other companies have done for people through their CSR measures? None of that matters to the altruists. Altruism, as a moral code, pays no attention whatsoever to any actual benefit that any particular beneficiary receives. Altruism's only concern is with the benefactor, and only in that the benefactor in some way loses in the equation and makes some kind of sacrifice. Altruists indicate as much when they respond to a given company's CSR efforts with snide accusations such as, "They wouldn't do that if they couldn't afford it." Well, of course not. How can anyone do anything he can't afford to do? Isn't it a good thing, then, that the company can afford such CSR measures for the benefit of those on the receiving end? Should we not hope that there will continue to be a positive impetus behind the company extending itself in such a way? Don't the altruists realize that if a company cannot afford to help the community through CSR, there'll be no CSR? Sure, the altruists realize that, but then so what? Altruism as such pays no attention to beneficiaries and how much they are affected. Altruism's only concern is in the sacrifice of the benefactor. Altruism's not even interested in who the beneficiary is, simply in who he is not, namely oneself. Any action taken for the benefit of oneself, regardless of what it is immoral, according to altruist ethics, while any action intended for the benefit of another, without any sort of personal gain or fulfillment, is considered moral in the altruist ethics. Thus, an altruist will observe that both Thomas Edison and Al Capone made millions of dollars, and thus find them both to be equally immoral. That the former earned his money through creativity and production, and the latter through criminality and violence, is of no consequence to altruism. According to altruist ethics, the moral failing common to both men is that their actions were motivated by a desire to improve their own conditions, and thus both are equally guilty. And what of the fact that Thomas Edison, in the process of making his millions, improved the life of the common man immeasurably, while Al Capone's typical operating procedure involved blackmail and murder? Well, so what, an altruist would say. That has no bearing on the matter at all within altruist ethics. Remember once more, altruism is utterly unconcerned with beneficiaries. It is only concerned with the benefactor, and in that the benefactor not himself benefit from his own actions. If you don't believe that, then just think about a fellow like Bill Gates. Why did Bill Gates only become a big hero once he announced that he wanted to give all his billions away to charity? Until then, he was a ruthless monopolist, the worst example from the dog-eat-dog world of business. And as long as he continued to be successful and make money, he continued to be tarred with that brush. Did it matter that he changed the lives of people around the world forever? Did it matter that he made all of us richer and that we have computers on our desks, and now even obsolete computers in our attics that are more powerful than all the computing power that existed in the whole world in, say, 1960, and that it is now affordable to the common man? No, our benefit does not matter. Altruism is not concerned with the benefits, just with who benefits. Notice, too, that Bill Gates suddenly became the darling of the altruists as soon as he announced he wanted to give it all away, even before specifying what charitable causes or worthwhile activities would be receiving his money. To the altruists, it was enough that he simply was going to sacrifice what he had in exchange for nothing in return. Just who or what would be at the receiving end of such magnanimity was a far distant secondary concern. Only sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice is important to altruism. Now, of course, many will point out that Bill Gates hardly worked alone and had many people under him that helped make him a success. Yes, I understand that, but that's not really so germane to this discussion, except to point out that even those people working under Gates did so with some kind of salary or other monetary or material gain in mind. They certainly did not work in order to sacrifice themselves in bringing software to the masses and to line the pockets of Gates without any expectation of getting something in return. Rather, the people under Gates worked in order to make a profit for themselves and knew that in order to maximize such profit, they needed to come up with products and services for which people would freely choose to part with their own hard-earned money. They had to create a win-win situation, which is the very thing that altruism opposes. This is the very thing that Steinbeck confuses when he sees positive moral attributes such as kindness and honesty as being the concomitants of failure, while holding that success depends on dishonesty and greed, when in fact the most lasting and beneficial successes are those that are based on mutual benefit. Of course, mutual benefit is of no moral value to altruism. A moral act must always involve an act of sacrifice on the part of the actor.
Red, you want to do anything you want to do.
more, you're listening to VSI Radio International. Feel free to send your questions or comments to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. Earlier this season, I discussed in passing Ronald McDonald House, the foundation set up by the McDonald's restaurant chain that operates and sponsors a series of residences for families of children who need to travel for medical treatments. Such an undertaking is of a special benefit to Swedish families, as this is a small country with limited medical resources. Anything but the most rudimentary of medical procedures requires patients to travel to one of only a handful of locations in the country with the required resources. Yet the cynical streak in many people shows its ugly head when they criticize Ronald McDonald House for merely being a PR instrument for McDonald's and that they hope to sell a few more hamburgers. To my mind, that may very well be the case, and I think that's fantastic. When I first mentioned this, fellow broadcaster Ramsey from Ramsey's Roadhouse wrote to me to point out something I hadn't thought of, namely that McDonald's is able to write off what it spends on Ronald McDonald House from its taxes. Yes, indeed. Yet another positive impetus behind the McDonald's company's continued support to Ronald McDonald House and the families it helps. The altruists are utterly unimpressed by such generosity and find that the mere fact that McDonald's itself does not make a sacrifice and perhaps even benefits from its charitable activities makes it all devoid of any moral worth, in altruist eyes. There are those who even want to see charitable donations no longer be tax-deductible. And if a given charity can no longer operate or raise enough funds to help people any longer as a result, what then? What about the poor people depending on it? Altruism has no answer. It's unconcerned with the fate of the beneficiaries. It's only concerned that the benefactor does not himself benefit from his actions. A charitable activity that operates at a loss or involves sacrifice can operate for a while, but it must eventually fall apart. When it does fall apart, the altruists will simply complain that not enough sacrifices had been made. A reorganization of such a charitable undertaking into a win-win situation is a non-starter to the altruists. It's sacrifice or no deal, as far as they're concerned. As to the fate of those who'd been depending on help, altruism takes no interest. Personally, I think it's a moral responsibility for any undertaking, especially charitable ones, to be arranged in such a way as to be self-sustaining and stable enough so that those depending on them can count on them if and when they're needed. Consider the basic theory on which insurance works. Let's take health insurance in particular. Now, most working people, even those earning very modest amounts, usually don't need insurance to cover, for example, a $40 earache. But most of us, even those who are fairly well off, would likely need a policy to cover a $40,000 heart operation. So you buy an insurance policy and pay premiums. The insurance company also collects premiums from many others buying policies and then has a large source of capital. The insurance company takes that money, invests it, makes lots more money, and then there's plenty of money available when one of its policyholders finally does need that $40,000 heart operation. Of course, I know in practice it can be more complicated than that, but that's the theory anyway, and that's the ideal, and it serves to demonstrate the point. So what's wrong with private insurance of this kind? Well, statists will object simply because the state is left out of the equation. But altruists will object because there's no sacrifice involved. Altruists will even complain that insurance companies earn tremendous sums of money on the hardships of a few people. Sure they do. That's the strength of it. By having the insurance company earn money, those policyholders who face hardships can be compensated. Win-win again. No sacrifice necessary. And that's why the wicked altruists who support socialized medicine, for instance, do so. Now, when I say wicked altruists who support socialized medicine, no, I'm not talking about your brother-in-law or any of your friends who might vote Democrat or any poor misguided friends you have up in Canada, so many of them seeming to believe that socialized medicine is the very essence of their national identity. They may sincerely believe that socialized medicine is for the benefit of those who could not otherwise afford health insurance. They're not wicked, they're just wrong, that's all. the wicked people are the altruists who, even when confronted with the hard facts and reasoned arguments demonstrating that some altruistic policy or another actually hurts people, will still not abandon altruism. At first, it's easy to get frustrated with such people as they seem to refuse to see reality. But really, it's you who need to face the reality that an altruist's primary interest is sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice, and that any argument based on a win-win situation will be regarded as being selfish by the altruist and be rejected out of hand. Think of how socialized medicine works. Its funding comes from the tax system. All the money collected through the tax system, be it great or small, all ends up in one big pot, being guarded by an agent of the state, holding a bayonet in one hand and a blank check on all our lives in the other. We mere serfs gather around the edge of the pot, hoping to get as large a serving as we can, but what we get has no relation to what we contributed. Altruism demands that we simply sacrifice whatever material values we have, and then statism demands that we wait for the state to apportion out benefits as it sees fit and according to its own priorities, which may not be the same as our own. Thus, now that the single big pot needs to be shared with socialized medicine, that means that there's so much less for other socialized industries, such as education, elderly care for the mentally insane, the plethora of directly redistributive programs, such as those for mothers of young children, poor relief, housing subsidies, farming subsidies, public transportation subsidies, and foreign aid. Furthermore, medical insurance is now competing for funds with purely administrative functions, such as infrastructure, the administration of justice, national defense, and law and order. Priority given to any one of those necessarily entails cuts to one or more of the others. Notice, too, that the altruists point out that, without exception, all such programs and departments are underfunded. Thus, if the government is failing to prioritize education and then decides to rectify the matter by budgeting more money to education and, in return, cuts funds to infrastructure, it's not long before parents complain about the poor state of the roads in which they have to travel when driving their children to school. You can set any department against any other you want, any perceived need. Why are hospitals understaffed while the police have time and resources to crack down on lemonade stands? Why are we giving so much foreign aid money to other countries when not enough social housing is being built in our own country? Why are we paying students subsidies for the luxury of studying at university when we have so many families go hungry? Indeed, why are we paying hungry families money when those of us working hard pay taxes that are often so high that we struggle to put food onto our own tables? There are surely thousands of such arguments and examples just like this, which at a very practical level may be good arguments against socialism. However, an altruist will take these very same arguments and see them as an argument for socialism, because in every case, no matter what priorities are set and then changed, somebody loses out, somebody sacrifices, and thus it's morally righteous in the eyes of altruism. It's not hard to see what this kind of altruism can do to a community and how it can destroy all positive human relationships. If the needs of another person place a moral obligation on you to sacrifice yourself, then the mere existence of other people is a threat to your own existence. Walking around town, if you can keep in mind that every plaster cast on every broken leg you see, every pram being pushed and every bottle of formula being given to a baby by its mother, every school you walk by at which you have no children enrolled, every tin of swill beer the park bench drunk is drinking, every national art gallery you never visit, every state-run radio station to which you never listen, all came at the cost of your shrunken hide and that you had no choice. Just how much kindness and respect can you really be expected to have for your fellow man? What kind of sincere relationship can exist between two people if the mere proximity to one another automatically turns them both into sacrificial victims and profiteers on sacrifice at the same time, in relation to one another? The basic virtue that a man is expected to demonstrate under altruism is self-denial. Sacrifice for the sake of sacrifice. Collectivism holds that the whole, the state, the community, indeed the collective, is the basic political unit, and that the individual is merely one element and is a lower priority than the collective itself. Thus an altruist collectivist aspect sees virtue in an individual sacrificing himself for the collective as such. Now in reality, there is no such thing as a collective that's greater than the sum of the individuals within it. Thus to hold the collective is a higher priority than the individual. It is simply to hold some individuals above other individuals. Still, within the morality of altruism, this is perfectly acceptable. Now, we discussed how altruism is only interested in sacrifice and is not concerned with whatever benefit accrues to the beneficiary. Yet it goes farther than this. Being only concerned with sacrifice, altruism takes no interest in any harm that befalls another human being. As long as the initial act was not done for one's own benefit, then anything goes. You'll meet people today who will quite openly admit that they cried when the Berlin Wall came down and communism collapsed generally. Such people often understand at a rational level that such was probably inevitable, but they are saddened because the idea was so beautiful, they think. All sorts of third world countries adopted socialistic economic policies immediately upon becoming independent from the metropolitan powers. Even those countries that had not become bloody tyrannies, but just take countries like Madagascar or Tanzania. Their socialist programs failed, as they must do. But the altruists respond, and I've heard it myself, by defending them with the argument, at least they tried. What? At least they tried? I mentioned that one of John Steinbeck's early mentors was the American writer and early Soviet apologist Lincoln Stephens. Upon finally paying a visit to Russia, he could not deny the evidence of his own eyes that the country, even at an early stage, was in shambles and suffered under dictatorship. Yet he could only conclude that what he saw was, in his words, a temporary condition of evil made tolerable by hope and a plan. Yes, the Soviets were trying as well, and that's enough for the altruists. Just how much evil will the altruists tolerate as long as there's hope and a plan behind it? No evil in history, no matter how great, has ever been committed without at least someone defending it on the grounds of service to someone else. Service to the party, service to the community, to the race, to the class, to God, to the children, to the environment, to the yet unborn future generation, to anyone or anything at all, just not to oneself. The bloodiest dictatorships in history, among them Nazi Germany and Soviet Union, were wholly altruistic societies. Every individual was expected to sacrifice himself for the state, or for any nebulous distant goal to be achieved at some undetermined time in the future. The Soviets said that they would eventually dismantle the state apparatus once they had finally reached a state of pure communism, under which no state would be necessary. Until then, the state would have ultimate and unlimited control over all aspects of life. The Nazis held the self-determination, pride, and freedom of the German people so greatly that while the Jews had a stranglehold on the German economy and foreign powers sought to undermine the rebuilding of the German nation, in the meantime all freedom and rights had to be suspended and even a system of industrial-scale murder be established, all for the benefit of the fatherland, the race, the people. You think that the Nazis and communists simply twisted altruism as a concept? Not at all. What actually happens to people who are at the receiving end of an altruistic act is of no concern in altruism. How many detective books have you read or films have you seen when at the end the perpetrator is finally caught having committed the criminal or dishonest act, or even just having been caught in a lie, and then pleads the banal cliché, "You see, I did it all for you, not for me, but for you." That's altruism. Who gets hurt and what actual benefit anyone might have derived are not important. All that is important is that the actor not benefit from his actions. If self-sacrifice is the highest moral duty, and if the collective is the highest moral end, if the rights of the individual, of any individual in particular, can and should be preempted for the interests of the collective, if the individual has no right to live for his own sake, but only to the extent that he serves others, then there is absolutely no reason why innocent people should not be shoved into gas chambers or dragged in front of firing squads. It is, in fact, my contention that without the pervasiveness of the altruist morality throughout the body politic, that such gruesome absurdities as Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia would never have existed. Generosity is one of the better qualities of man, though as a virtue it is rather minor. I find it to be far less important than honesty, courage, a sense of justice. But I might leave that for another episode. Certainly, generosity and human kindness can be identified in an act of giving, but that same act can be seen in two different ways by two different people. A generous person giving a hungry man a sandwich will do so in order for that man no longer to be hungry. An altruist will give the sandwich in order to deprive himself of a sandwich. He could just as well have thrown the sandwich away to nobody's benefit, and the ethics of altruism would see no difference in the morality of either action. Clearly, generous people are the salt of the earth. Altruists are monsters. Thank you for joining me tonight on VSI Radio International. The program returns next week, as usual, on this channel, 7490 kHz, at 7 p.m. Eastern or 1 a.m. Central European Time. Until then, this is Paul Lambert inviting you to extend someone else an act of generosity which you yourself are truly happy to do. Good luck.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.